This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. District Council 37 is the city's largest union of city workers. We represent 125,000 members, and we're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Wednesday, Sunday evenings at 8 p.m., and we rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. You can also check out past episodes on our website, www.dc37.net. And I would implore you right from the beginning to follow us on Twitter, check us out on Instagram, and on Facebook. And this evening, we have the Director of Research and Bargaining, Steve Kreisberg, a fellow who's been on the show before from AFSCME in District of Columbia. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, Chris. Great to talk to you. You know I'm a huge fan of the show.
I know you are. And it's always a pleasure to have you here, even though it's not always a pleasure to talk about what we're talking about. And what I wanted to talk about this evening was there has been so much noise about the first 100 days of Donald Trump's presidency. And I wanted to take it off some of the more rhetorical aspects into, policy. What are we seeing? What is Donald Trump actually putting out there as policy, which we will have to live with for the next 4 years? You're always one of the smartest guys in any room I'm in. What are you seeing?
Well, first, the good news, he hasn't dropped any nuclear bombs on anybody just yet. So I think we can take some solace in that. But on the domestic front, which will be more of my focus, although his foreign policy does scare the hell out of me.
He actually told people that he was sending an armada towards North Korea, and the ship was actually going the other way.
And I think that's actually a great metaphor for his entire presidency. because if you think about both his candidacy and what he's done on assumption of office, you know, he says he's going one place, but it seems like the ship is going the other way.
It's not funny, but what are we going to do here in this conversation? It rises to the absurd at times.
It does. And it's, we would make for an interesting discussion about the politics of this and how this all came to pass. Because nowhere before in my lifetime have we ever seen an elected official at such a high office, even going down to governors and mayors who've been able to get away with this kind of behavior in terms of the mismatch between rhetoric and reality. People wanted to call John Kerry a flip-flopper for a snippet of a statement that he said, which was a mischaracterization of what he said, and that stuck. And yet this guy, the flipping and the flopping never stops.
And it's huge.
Let's talk about infrastructure. This is one of the positive things that the man from New York City said he would do when he went to Washington, D.C. He correctly diagnosed a problem that the country is badly in need of an infusion of capital for infrastructure. You see it in New York City every day, but New York City, of course, is not alone in that. So what does this budget do? Now, the budget is a political document, but it's also an expression of your priorities if you're the chief executive, which Mr. Trump is. So one of the things he does is he abolishes a program within the Department of Transportation called TIGER, which provides vital infrastructure funding. I mean, this is what creates good jobs, improves our roads and transportation systems, and facilitates commerce, which creates even more jobs. In 2016, the program provided $500 billion in funding.
Oh, wow.
High-income projects over the previous, $500 million in funding, in that year alone. Since 2009, we got about $4.5 billion in that program, and now he's wiping it out. And the nice thing about the way that program worked is it was $4.6 billion, as I said, over that five-year period, but it leveraged total infrastructure investments of $16 billion when you consider private, state, and local financing sources, which are necessary to get to kind of that federal money, right? Because you only get the federal money if you put up a little bit of local money yourself. So we basically got to $16 billion of infrastructure investment over a few years, and now that program's gone. So that makes little sense, but Mr. Trump also said he was going to take care of the forgotten people because they would be forgotten no more.
Right.
And of course the people who that message most resonated with were those in what is sometimes, deemed flyover country, right? The Oklahomas, the Iowas, the Missouris, these are the folks who supposedly resent people like you and me, Chris, because we're big city elites.
Right.
Without getting into that, again, that political discourse, so what does this president propose? He proposes to abolish the Department of Agriculture's Water and Waste Disposal Loan Program. This is a loan and grant program which provides, you know, again, vital infrastructure funding to rural communities who otherwise would not have access to capital because they're small communities. They can't go to the bond market like New York City can. And this particular program was a lifeline for these rural communities who need good jobs, but also water they can actually drink. So this is capital infrastructure to purify water in communities that need that water purified, so they can live, much less thrive, in commerce. So you not only create good jobs, but you provide a healthy environment for people, and you can create the means to have further economic development. But what does Trump do? He abolishes the program.
Do we have any sense of where that thought process comes from? I mean, is that what the Republicans are telling him to do, or is?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to say. You don't want to disassociate himself from his administration too much, because he doesn't deserve that, in a sense. He owns this.
Right.
But there's a guy named Mick Mulvaney from South Carolina who's his budget director, and this guy is—he's one of the Tea Party crazies. Frankly, he is one of the guys that was elected over the year who thinks that government can do little good.
Right.
This is his budget. This is a Paul Ryan, Mick Mulvaney budget. And I think what we're really seeing with the election of Trump is a guy who doesn't really have a firm ideology, who is really reprehensible in so many ways in terms of his personal behavior and the kinds of views and the things that he says. And many Republicans were reluctant to embrace him, as we know, because of that. But you know, but Paul Ryan would say, "Well, you know, I only need his left hand because that's what he's going to use to sign all those bills that I give him."
Right, right, right.
Well, Paul Ryan has proved himself as inadequate, if not incompetent, as a speaker, and hasn't been able to deliver anything. And Mick Mulvaney, who's the budget guy from the Republicans, is of the same ilk. And what I mean by that is these guys are not fit to govern. They are fit to talk. They are fit to come up with things like repeal and replace, a nice catchy slogan. And that we should have, you know, healthcare choices and this other rhetoric that they use. But then what they discover when they have to govern is what Mr. Trump has now discovered. Healthcare is complicated.
Right.
Right? Isn't that what the president said? And then he was amazed by the education he got over a piece of chocolate cake from the Chinese premier.
Right, right.
When she told him that basically, you know, North Korea is not really very obedient to the Chinese because of, millennium-long grudges that they've had within Asia and repeated, cases of hegemony back and forth, it came as a surprise to Mr. Trump that North Korea had a relationship to China, which was not necessarily the same as the relationship that Delaware has to the United States.
Well, it
wasn't a surprise to anybody who pays attention to things.
Well, let's go back to healthcare for a second, because your point about these guys don't govern, and that they don't, in fact, they don't believe in government, and they attacked Obama's healthcare plan repeatedly over a period of 8 years, and now they have come up with. They came up with a plan that nobody liked. They couldn't get passed, and it's not clear where they're going with the health care plan.
Right, and now all the Trump folks are, what we've heard over the last couple of days, they are obsessed with the fact of trying to get this through the House within the next 10 days so they can say they did it in the first 100 days. So it's not about providing what candidate Trump referred to as a beautiful health care plan that he already had.
Right.
No, it's about political statements now. Which is really what the Republican Party has been all about. They're really about two things. They're about cutting taxes for the rich and wealthy and making political statements to those who are not rich and wealthy so they will buy into those tax cuts for the rich and wealthy. And we saw that in their health care plan, which stripped away all of the taxes that we use to fund the Affordable Care Act, except for one, the one that actually hit workers, which was sometimes referred to as the Cadillac tax, which is the tax on high-cost health plans. But these are health plans that, you know, provide services to keep people healthy and cover them when they're sick. And almost all plans will eventually be subject to that tax over the next 10 or 15 years if it's not repealed. And that's the only tax they left in place because it hit workers. But they did think enough of it to repeal a tax that is only applies to the executives of insurance companies who make high salaries. So what the Affordable Care Act did.
Look, I know where this is going.
Insurance company executives should not be making huge outlandish salaries, so we're going to tax those. We're not going to consider those eligible as a business expense to be deducted as a business expense. So it's not higher taxes for the executives. It just says the companies can't deduct, as a normal business operating expense, these multi-million dollar salaries. Those things, that had to be repealed, and it was repealed by the Paul Ryan health care plan. But the tax on the health benefits of the New York City workers, right, the people who are members of DC 37 and the members of of 1199 and the members of the Communication Workers of America.
The working folks that Donald Trump was going to help. The working
folks. Those folks are going to have to pay taxes on their health care. But God forbid if an insurance company executive who makes a living denying people's claims, God forbid if they would have to have their companies not be able to deduct their outrageous salaries from their business expenses.
We're talking with Steve Kreisberg. He is the Director of Research at the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees in Washington, D.C. We've just got a couple of minutes. I knew this was going to go by fast, and it did. Let's talk a little bit about the Supreme Court, Gorsuch, and what this means regarding the life of public sector unions. And we've got about 2 minutes to do it in.
Okay, well,
lucky you.
Yeah, well, so here we go again, right? So we have, the Republicans have done a fairly decent job of consolidating their economic power, and now they're really gone after an effort to consolidate their political power. And so really what Justice Gorsuch brings for them is a guy who can very reliably be counted upon to allow Republicans to gerrymander legislative districts, deny people of color, the elderly and the young, the franchise of the right to vote. And, of course, as pertains to public employee unions, try to deny us collective bargaining rights and strong collective bargaining rights so that we can get our fair share of the economic gains of the country. So we're right back into a situation, which we were facing before Justice Scalia's death, where the Supreme Court is going to consider a case that is going to reverse a four-decades-long precedent that was decided 9-0 by a previous court. In other words, 40 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court, consisting of very conservative justices at that time, including some that aren't conservative, decided in a unanimous decision that public employee unions could ask or require non-members to pay their fair share costs of representation. Not their cost of any political activity that we engage in, but just the cost of representation. The collective bargaining agreement, the negotiation of wage increases, et cetera, that their fair share of those costs everybody should bear, right? This Supreme Court is poised to say, no, we're going to allow those people to be free riders.
I'm running out of time. We're going to be fighting that, I hope. I know we will.
We will be fighting it. We'll be fighting it in court. We have limited mechanisms, right? Because it'll be a decision that's probably rendered 5-4 against the unions, and that'll be that. They're interpreting the Constitution, and so the way to fight that is for us to build our internal strength, and AFSCME and other unions have programs doing just that. The teachers' unions are doing it. We're doing it, and we're going to have to get much stronger internally, and we're going to have to maintain our power, and the only way to do that is to continue to communicate with our members and be sharp representatives of our people.
Steve Kreisberg, AFSCME's Director of Research and Bargaining. Sir, thank you very much. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Always a pleasure, Chris. Thanks.
We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. This is State of the Union, the DC 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. President Trump is proposing to cut funding to public housing to the tune of $6.2 billion. On April 20th in Federal Plaza in Lower Manhattan, we were part of a rally to stop Trump's cut to HUD. And we've got a clip of that event.
If we have no funds to take care of our family, I'm a single mom with grandkids, and this would impact me drastically.
15,000 city workers live in public housing today. And we will not stand for a budget that cuts a basic human right and funds more wars and far more military spending. It is our turn to tell Congress and to tell the elected officials that we will remember. Come November of 18, we will remember what you do for public housing in New York and across this country. Yes. We will remember what votes you take, and we will not sit idly when you cut one of the basic human rights, and that's the right to public housing.
That was Executive Director Henry Garrido, a very passionate Henry Garrido, talking about the Trump budget cuts. And joining us now by phone is Councilmember Richie Torres of the Bronx. Welcome to the show, Councilmember.
It's an honor to be here.
I just wanted to start off, you know, we have a very vocal presence on social media. And once in a while, we will have folks saying, why don't you just stick to the contract and negotiating the contract? And I think sometimes members and other community folks don't make the connection between politics and the quality of folks' lives. And I was hoping that you would, to start off this segment, talk a little bit about that importance.
Well, I'll take one example is public housing.
Right.
Like, we all have a stake in public housing. There are members of DC 37 who live in public housing or who have friends or family members who live in public housing. And even if you do not live in public housing yourself, you benefit from the stability that it provides to hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers. And if public housing were to collapse under the weight of financial disinvestment on the part of the federal government, that's going to inflict real damage on the workforce. So we all have a vested interest in preserving the public institutions that employ and house and provide health care to the employees of the municipal labor force.
And unless people are willing to get involved by way of, you know, the rally that you were an integral part of, these things don't happen unless there is noise, there is agitation, there are folks speaking out on these issues.
Exactly right. I mean, progress never happens by accident. It happens as a product of smart organizing, a combination of the inside game and the outside game. And the Republicans have the power. Donald Trump is in control of the presidency. You have a Republican Congress that's intent on dismantling the social safety net. The best tool that we have is resistance. Resistance in the courts and resistance on the streets. And everyone has to contribute their fair share of resistance. So.
You know, sometimes we get criticized. Folks are saying, you know, it's not the world isn't really about Democrats and Republicans. It's about we're all part of one country. But the fact of the matter is that the Republicans have made life very difficult for our members and folks in the working class. This is not just partisan politics. This is about different ways that people see the world and the role of government in the world.
Look, we're all Americans, but to acknowledge our common identity as Americans does not mean that we should be willfully blind to the ideological differences between the two parties, right? You have one party that is by and large committed to the labor movement, and then you have another party that wants to appoint Supreme Court justices intent on eviscerating public sector collective bargaining. So there are huge differences. There are fundamental differences between the two parties, and it would be foolish to ignore those differences.
You are the youngest member of the city council.
I am the youngest member, commonly mistaken for the council interns.
No. tell us about the road to the city council. Although it's a short road since you're only 29, right?
29. I ran when I was 24, And my desire to run for public office was born of disillusionment. I just became deeply disillusioned with the political establishment. You know, I saw, you know, the two previous state senators in my district were both, are both in jail for corruption. You know, I had two assembly members in the southern part of my district who went to jail after committing bribery. The Bronx has a long tradition of dynastic politics. You had absentee elected officials. And I said, rather than complain about the failure of political leadership around me, why not run for public office myself? Why not become the change I wish to see? And so I ran for public office. It was originally, I was one of nine candidates, and then it eventually whittled down to five candidates. I was actually running against a candidate who had the same exact name as the outgoing incumbent. So the
is that right?
Incumbent, yes. The outgoing incumbent was Joe Arroyo. You could make a movie about this.
Yeah.
I think there is a movie about this.
Yeah,
actually.
Right.
The outgoing incumbent was Joe Rivera, and my opponent was Joe Rivera, and he was leading people to believe that he was the council member. He was taking credit for all the capital investments that the council member had made. So on television, you know, we had a shouting match, and I just publicly accused him of political identity theft, referred to him as the fake Joe Rivera. But I won largely on the strength of door-to-door campaigning. I knocked on 6,000 doors and spoke to enough voters to win the election.
Now, this is not to take anything away from your accomplishment there, but it's not as if you woke up one day and said, I'm tired of this. I'm going to go do it myself. I mean, you clearly have had an interest in civic life since, you know, for a while, correct? I mean,
I did. I mean, I was an intern for a council member since I was 16.
Right, right.
And I was, so I've been, and I interned in the mayor's office when I was 15 as a sophomore, junior in high school. So I've had a longstanding interest in politics. But I never thought of myself as an elected official. I never imagined myself in elected office. I thought of myself as a behind-the-scenes player. So it's a role to which I have grown accustomed, and I'm embracing it.
And what do you think about, I guess the question is engagement. I mean, the constant challenge for us all who are actively involved in trying to accomplish change is to get people involved. And I'm just wondering, you know, the results of the election in November, what do you think about what November meant?
Engagement matters, like even at the margins, right? If we had just a little more engagement in some key states, we would have won the election.
Right.
So even improving engagement at the margins can have massive consequences.
I think
for the future of the country, for the future of the labor movement. And so that should be our number one priority. I mean, our greatest, you know, the moneyed interest that are intent on capturing our politics, they have money. We can't compete with them in terms of money. What we can compete with them is people power. And mobilizing people to be engaged in the civic and political life of our country, that's our best hope for steering our country in a pro-labor direction.
And when you think about the change, I mean, the fact that we're going from Barack Obama to Donald Trump is still something
It is staggering. I think Obama was probably a better president than we deserve, and Donald Trump is a worse president than we deserve.
And it's only been 100 days.
It's only been 100 days, right? And every day is a new day with Donald Trump.
And every day is a contradiction of yesterday.
Yes.
Let's talk about how that proposed $6.2 billion cut, what would it mean to New York City housing?
It would be catastrophic. It would deeply destabilize the operations of the New York City Housing Authority. So the loss of $10 million represents the loss of 100 caretakers. So imagine losing hundreds of millions of dollars in operating and capital funds. I mean, NYCHA has been so savagely starved of federal funding in the past few decades that it cannot afford to absorb even more budget cuts. And I'm concerned that Donald Trump, the presidency of Donald Trump, is the gravest threat to public housing in the 83-year history of the New York City Housing Authority.
And the city budget came out this week. The mayor released his budget. The process now, and what are some of your responses to the budget that came out?
So the mayor presented his executive budget. We're going to dedicate the month of May to holding hearings on the executive budget. So I will hold a hearing on the public housing piece. The mayor is making some historic investments in public housing. So not only are we allocating $1 billion over the next 10 years? But it appears that the mayor is going to allocate even more capital funding for facade improvements in public housing. And in a world of limited resources, it's wise for the city to invest dollars in roofs and bricks, which are the most critical needs of a building. You know, the enemy of a building is water. And if we can shore up the bricks and replace the roofs and prevent water penetration, then we can extend the life of these buildings well into the future.
And
prevent mold and leaks, which is the most chronic problem in public housing.
And in terms of the year ahead, there's going to be changes this election cycle. There are folks who are term limited. The council speaker is stepping down. So what do you think about any crystal ball you have about the speakership?
I mean, I can tell you who's not going to be speaker. It's not going to be Richie Torres.
Okay. Fair enough.
So that's my crystal ball prediction.
Fair enough. And in addition to the rally that was held on April 20th, moving forward through the Trump budget process, what do you think New Yorkers should be doing?
We have to be careful not to be complacent.
And
because Donald Trump has immense power over the future of the labor movement, over the future of New York City. And we have to resist him at every turn, right? The future of our city, the future of the social safety net is at stake, and we have to be vigilant in defending it.
We're talking with Council Member Richie Torres of the Bronx. That's the 15th council district, is that correct?
It's the greatest council district in New York City, yes.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. I hope you'll come back and talk some more. We've been talking about the Trump budget, and I think we've made a pretty passionate case for why it's important that we all get involved.
Thank you so much, and I love DC 37. So.
Thank you. Okay, that's just about all the time we have for this show. I want to thank our guests, AFSCME Director of Research and Bargaining Steve Kreisberg and City Council Committee on Public Housing Chair Richie Torres. Tomorrow is May Day, the day that trade unionists around the globe celebrate labor's achievements, history, and recognize the contributions that workers have made to our societies worldwide. May Day has shared a date with International Workers' Day since the 1880s. At the time, labor movements around the world were fighting for fair work accommodations like 8-hour workdays and unions. The date was chosen because it aligned with the history of the Haymarket Affair in Chicago, where police killed 4 people at a peaceful protest after someone threw a bomb into the crowd. Here in New York City, the New York May 1 Coalition will hold a rally in March that begins at Union Square at noon. And the New York Immigration Coalition is holding another at Foley Square to fight back against President Trump's attacks against workers, immigrants, and refugees. Join DC 37 Executive Director Henry Garrido and our sisters and brothers at the Foley Square rally. For more information, call 212-815-1550. My name is Chris Policano. This is the DC 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. and then again Wednesdays at 1:30. Please follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and also we're also on www.dc37.net. The engineer is Andrea Minocchio. Rudy Orozco is the producer. Until next time, ciao. We'll be right back.